Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. For Walnut Wednesday today, we're talking about the congestion at the ports. Here's Taylor Chalstrom.
This segment was sponsored by the California Walnut Board.
Hi, welcome to My Ag Life. I'm here with Roger Isom, President and CEO of Western Agricultural Processors Association. Roger, there's been some issues with shipping port congestion on the West Coast for some time now, but I want to get your perspective on the situation. You know, what are you seeing currently and how has it been affecting the tree nut industry?
It's getting worse. I think last year, amidst, you know, the height of the COVID pandemic, we kind of thought that was the worst and it would get better after the Chinese New Year. And I'll say that it slowed down a bit, but now this year, and unfortunately, the peak input or incoming products imports from Asia are in the fourth quarter. And that problem coincides with the fact that we export, especially on the tree nut side, the majority of our products in that fourth quarter as well. So it's worse. It's to say it's a disaster in some ways is an understatement. It's costing us a lot of money at a time where we really don't need to be spending it on this. And it's having a huge impact on the ability to get our product out of California and to our marketplace.
Yeah, no, I've been seeing some stuff in the news, just like pictures and stuff of what the ports look like right now. There's so many ships out there in the water, you know, they just can't really seem to get a hold on it. I talked to some people a few months ago about this issue as well, and they seemed a little more optimistic back then. I'm just curious what you see the foreseeable future to look like for imports and exports at this point in time.
Well, I got to tell you, I think we were of the same mindset last year in late spring. I think we all felt it was getting better. Maybe we finally turned the corner. We did not. And so at this point, I don't think there's any real end in sight. Both the federal government and to a lesser degree, the state government are starting to make some things happen, but they're really Band-Aids. You know, one of the big ones, which we think could help, is to get the West Coast ports open 24/7. They're, for the most part right now, they're not. There's one terminal within the port of LA that is, but we need them all open. And that'll allow those trucks to get in there, get the containers out, and really start to move some product. But there's 70 some cargo ships outside that aren't even at the port yet. They're simply out on the bay or outside of the bay drifting that we need to get in and get unloaded. And then we need them to have enough time to where they aren't rushing empties back to Asia that they're going to take our product back. A lot of these ships have spent so much time down there that it's not worth it for them to come up to Oakland and pick up our exports. They're simply returning to Asia. Because they get paid a huge premium right now, $25,000 a container and more to bring imports to the United States. So it's very lucrative on that Asia to United States thoroughfare. Going back, not so much.
You talk about this issue about keeping the ports open 24/7. I've definitely seen some stuff in the news about that as well. But you say that only one part of the Los Angeles port is open 24/7 at the moment. How does the port industry really go about getting all the ports open 24/7? You know, how big of a logistical issue is that? Is it a labor issue? What really needs to happen there?
It's purely a labor issue, but it's not just bodies. The longshoremen are highly skilled people and their process that they take to put somebody into the equipment. They go through extensive training. So you just don't go out there and hire 30 people and say, hey, here you go. You've got to hire a lot of people. You've got to train them. You've got to have them shadow people that are doing it. And this is a months long process to get those up and up. And as you know, as I'm sure you drive around, you know, any of the cities right now, we can't find truck drivers, restaurants can't find servers or cooks. I mean, there just doesn't seem to be a lot of people that want to work right now. And so that's another added challenge. Even though a longshoreman job is a very good, high-paying job, those are, you know, something that needs to be taken into consideration right now. it's going to be a challenge. This is not going to happen overnight. Quite frankly, I don't see it happening, getting all of the terminals open until we're well into 22. And even then it's going to take a while to ramp up.
Some of that stuff obviously needs to happen on the poor people's end, but what about on the ag professionals end? Do you have any recommendations for what some of these ag professionals in the Trina industry can do to maybe mitigate some of these issues, maybe things they can advocate for, meetings they can go to, et cetera?
I wish I knew the answer to that question. I think that all of the ag groups, trade associations, people like that have been screaming for well over a year. As I stated, this was a problem, last year. It's a worse problem now. We've been going to our congressional folks, even to our state folks who really have very little oversight over this, which really speaks to the issue. The federal aspect of this is that this comes under the jurisdiction of the Federal Maritime Commission, and they have limited oversight. These are all foreign shipping companies. We have no more U.S. Flag shipping companies anymore. And so we're really at the mercy of what they want to do. Essentially, they can go tell us to go pound sand. So we're trying to find ways to work around it. We've got guys that have shipped pistachios to Houston and Galveston, but at a huge cost. On some other commodities, I know cotton, there's actually been an air freight shipment to Peru, again, at a loss, but simply to keep the market place there that they've had and satisfy their customers before they go to somewhere else. There's a little port down in LA called Port of Hueneme. They're in Ventura, Oxnard area. It's a smaller port, can't really take the big, huge ships, but we've had some guys ship a few containers out of that on some of the smaller ships. Again, just trying to meet their marketplace and their customer demands. Again, it isn't going to solve our problem, but maybe if you've got a customer that you really need to get the product to, maybe that's another way to do it. There's hearings. I know congressional folks have been taking tours of the ports, trying to see what they can do. We've got another meeting later this week at the state level where there's select committees in both the Assembly and Senate on ports and goods movement. They're going to be holding a joint hearing on Wednesday in Sacramento, trying to hear kind of what's the lay of the land, what's the problem, what are the causes, and what are the potential solutions. Again, the state has very little jurisdiction here. Some of the things that they might be able to do is lower the age on the commercial driver's license so we can get possibly more truckers. I'm not real high on that. Don't know if that'll help. I know that the governor's talked about maybe getting some other land around the ports, vacant lots where we can store containers so that it's not so congested at the port. There's been some talk about maybe some inland storage areas or offloading like French Camp, where there's a rail that takes things from the Port of Oakland, rails them, and then we can pick them up, offload them here, and keep some of the trucks out of the port. Again, these are all, Band-Aid solutions that will help alleviate a little bit, but we need a wholesale change here. We need something to really open up and get this thing moving, because we're in crisis mode right now.
That's certainly what I've been hearing at the very least. I'm curious what Western Ag Processors Association, what you guys are doing specifically to kind of help or advocate for this issue.
Again, anything possible. We have been briefing on a regular basis, our congressional representatives and Senate representatives. We have spoke to all the district export councils, made presentations to them on just the economic impact. I've been providing several reports to the Federal Maritime Commissioners directly, in particular, Commissioner Dye, who's in charge of Fact Finding 29, which is looking into this issue. Again, not a lot of teeth for her to do much, but at least, making her aware of all the charges. It's one of the things that happens with this congestion is that we can send a container in there, have it assigned to a ship, and then that ship cancel or get delayed. Well, then there's all kinds of fees that we're just getting pounded with right now. I've got customers or members of ours that are paying $10,000 to $30,000 a month in additional fees. We're not going to recover that. we can't charge more for our walnuts, or our pistachios, or almonds, or cotton, or anything else, just because we had to pay storage fees or demurrage fees or West Coast port congestion fees. These fees just nickel and diming us to death and really making us uncompetitive.
I appreciate you just being really frankly honest about the outlook of the situation, whether it's positive or negative. Obviously, in the future, we hope to see a more positive edge to this situation, obviously, since, like you said, this has been going on since the start of COVID, coming up on passing a year and a half now. Roger, thank you for coming on today and bringing some additional light to this issue. We hope to hear some more positive updates on the issue in the near future.
So do we,
guys. Definitely. This is Taylor with My Ag Life signing off.
The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow. Salty, closed soils can render your crops unproductive. DSAL, formulated by AgroPlanté, is specially designed for sodic and saline sodic soils. DSAL will displace sodium and wash it out of the root zone with irrigation to enhance your soil structure, water penetration, and vitality by decreasing soil salinity. AgroPlanté's DSAL flocculates your soil to promote soil aeration and drainage. With DSAL, you'll create a better soil environment for your crop roots and optimize yield. Contact AgroPlanté today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at agroplanté.com. AgroMiora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, AgroMiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, AgroMiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Here's your news for today. Efforts to increase drought resiliency and water use efficiency in the West are getting a boost. Gary Crawford has more.
The sound of an open irrigation canal. Obviously, this sound recorded at a time when there was plenty of water available, pretty good flow there. But right now in the West, it's a different story. It might sound more like this. And according to Agriculture Department meteorologist Brad Rippey,
this is really becoming one of the most significant and protracted droughts of the western United States.
And in California alone, because of practically no rain or snow to refill water reservoirs,
63% of its stored water has been lost since midsummer 2019.
And so farmers in the West are dealing with droughts that are lingering longer and more intense, making water scarce or unavailable at all.
But there are some things that we can do to help the situation.
That's Astor Boozer. He's the Western Regional Conservationist for the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Natural Resources Conservation Service. He says several federal departments have programs to help producers conserve water and mitigate against drought, but
not one agency can do it all themselves. So it's more of that, how can we collaborate together to get this work done?
And he says that is happening in line with Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack's emphasis on
partnerships with agriculture, forestry, tribes, states, businesses, universities, nonprofits.
And also with other federal departments. Astor Boozer says USDA is putting $21 million into the Interior Department's Water Smart program, working with that agency on 40 water projects.
To help farmers, ranchers conserve water through building drought resiliency within their communities. It gives us an opportunity to leverage monies and resources of irrigation districts, water districts, and other organizations, and coordinate these efforts to conserve and use water more efficiently, mitigate future water conflict, and really accomplish other benefits that contribute to the water supply sustainability within the Western United States.
And for farmers who irrigate crops, those projects might take the form of things like
putting in additional pipe, closing canals, or actually reinforcing some of that overall infrastructure that has declined, decayed in some form or fashion.
And that has been wasting millions of gallons of precious water through leakage and evaporation. Boozer says collaboration among all the stakeholders will help to speed up the water conservation work in the West. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
A joint mission by NASA, the U.S. Geological Survey, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture is helping farmers and ranchers maximize water efficiency. Technology that aims to track water use across 17 Western states went live on October 21st, called OpenET. The program provides satellite monitoring to measure evapotranspiration. That is the process by which water evaporates from land and emits from plants. The mission can improve measurements on water use to sustain crops. A new app is seeking agritourism businesses to connect consumers with where their food comes from. Michael Clements shares more on the American Farm Bureau Foundation for Agriculture effort.
The American Farm Bureau Foundation for Agriculture this week announced a new mobile app to connect consumers with agrotourism venues. Launching next spring, Foundation Education Outreach Director Julia Recco says the American Farm Trail app will help consumers learn more about where their food comes from.
One really fun way to get folks to learn about where their food comes from is to get them onto a farm and to offer them that really organic learning experience. And we also plan on adding additional learning opportunities to the app with our My American Farm games and other educational resources.
Through the app, consumers will be able to search for agrotourism locations near them.
When they find one on the app, there's listed information about that agrotourism location, and so they can be prepared when they get there to have a really fun experience where they're seeing how their food is grown and maybe picking some for themselves and just learning more about agriculture in their area.
Farmers and ranchers interested in being listed on the app can set up a profile now.
We are looking for agritourism and tour locations to sign up on the American Farm Trail app, and there's a really easy way to do it. You go to farmtrailapp.com and you fill out the registration form. And we actually have a how-to guide on that website where we just offer some tips on what kind of information you might want to add to your profile.
Again, learn more at farmtrailapp.com. Michael Clements, Washington.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture is allocating $1.15 billion in grants and loans for projects helping rural communities access high-speed internet. The effort is intended to provide capital for broadband projects that serve low-population areas lacking internet connections at speeds of at least 25 megabits for downloading and 3 megabits for uploading. Priority will be given to projects submitted by local governments, tribes, and nonprofits. USDA's new Undersecretary for Rural Development says her mission area is perhaps a quiet one regarding the breadth and scope of rural economic and community development it supports. Rod Bain reports.
I want all Americans to understand that rural America is critically important to our nation's economy.
Education in that regard will be one of the goals for Sochil Torres-Small in her new role as the Agriculture Department's Undersecretary for Rural Development. Another goal is continued strategic investment in rural infrastructure to promote economic growth in communities, counties, and regions.
Really, it's about the investments that bring communities' vision to life.
Investment in both traditional infrastructure and new innovations in areas such as climate-smart renewable energy sources, buildings, and resiliency.
That means investing in rural communities that are on the front line of climate change, as well as increasing equity so that everyone, no matter where they live, can have their shot at the American dream.
And the undersecretary acknowledges that such diversity in scope of project, of demographic, of community need, is based on the makeup and goals of the community recipients themselves.
That can be different for every community.
She offers examples of rural development funded projects as illustrations of that point. first.
A few years ago, Rural Development funded two major water and sewer projects in West Point, Georgia. Water and sewer may not be the thing that everyone thinks about, but it is crucial for building jobs and opportunity in rural communities. In that case, it actually allowed Kia, the car maker, to build a major car making facility there. And so they've brought thousands of new high quality jobs to the community and attracted additional suppliers to that local economy.
Then there is an example of RD work regarding affordable housing in rural areas.
Not everyone knows, but how challenging affordable housing can be in rural communities, especially in southern New Mexico, colonias, which are homes that lack the basic infrastructure, whether it's utilities to their homes, whether it's running water. And Rural Development funds direct loans for housing. And what you do when you have investments in new housing in rural communities also gives you the chance to build that infrastructure so that they're not having to worry about getting propane in their house, but rather have connection to the electricity grid and the services necessary to thrive in rural America.
And regarding her new mission as Rural Development Undersecretary, Torres Small says,
I am so deeply grateful to get to serve in rural development, which often is kind of the quiet force that works across rural communities to get things done.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's our news for today. We will be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Welcome back. The California State Board of Food and Agriculture focused on opportunities and on-farm innovations related to climate smart agriculture at its meeting on Tuesday, but they started with a legislative update from Deputy Secretary Rachel O'Brien of the CDFA. Here is part of that update.
Wanted to give you guys just a flavor of the bills that came up this year. You know, the bills I'm going to go through are definitely not exhaustive. But just a snapshot of some of the things that the department was working on and engaged on, as well as some things that became kind of higher priorities as the year moved along. First up is AB 45. This is a bill by Assemblymember Aguilar Curry. It establishes a regulatory structure at CDPH for food, beverage, and cosmetic products containing no more than 0.3 concentration of THC hemp. This was a multi-year effort for the Assemblywoman, and she got it across the finish line this year. It was signed by the governor. It will require CDFA to collaborate with the Department of Public Health to develop a process to share information to facilitate the compliance and enforcement for any unlicensed manufacturers or the sale of hemp that does not meet specified requirements. One notable thing on this bill that became quite controversial is the bill does prohibit the sale of smokable hemp flower and products in state until the legislature establishes an inhalable, a tax on inhalable products. The Assemblywoman did indicate that she's interested in pursuing this in the next year. So we could see that be introduced, but there were a number of our folks in the hemp cultivator community who were unhappy about this. I want to make sure I flag that for the committee, the board. Next up is AB 623. This was an classic omnibus bill. It did include a number of different provisions, one of which was a CDFA kind of non-sponsored item. The bill made clarifying changes to our certified farmers market operators. But in addition to that, it also prohibits district agricultural association board of directors from officially being seated on the board or participating in board meetings until they have completed their mandatory forms and training that's required by state law and as determined by the department. And then lastly, it authorizes the California Apple Commission to change the number of districts and their boundaries if they so choose to by a 2/3 vote of its members. Next up is AB 888 by Assemblymember Levine. This bill would allow what are called mobile slaughter operators to slaughter multiple livestock that are not of their own raising and from multiple owners, so long as that operator and the producers they're working with are registered with CBFA. The bill creates a license and registration process for that, and then ensures that those operations are conducted in a manner that is safe for human, consumption, animals, as well as the environment. And the bill did eliminate the cap on the number of animals that a mobile slaughter operator is permitted to slaughter, while putting some other guardrails in place to ensure public health. And we also had AB 1009 by Assemblymember Bloom that established the Farm to Community Food Hub program. This will help create and support food hubs that aggregate products from farms and distribute them to schools and food banks and other community resources such as hospitals. This bill did get funding that was included in the budget. And it also has this nice nexus and collaboration with our farm to school program. Great. So these are just some key bills. Over then on the Senate side, we had SB 27. This was a Senator Skinner bill that creates a California Carbon Sequestration and Climate Resiliency Project Registry. And this is a first time thing that will maintain a list of eligible but unfunded greenhouse gas emission and climate projects for public or private entities to be able to fund. So for example, we know that our SWEET programs, our healthy soil programs have been oversubscribed, but there's lots of great projects out there that can still be funded. And so this gives a chance for foundations, philanthropy, private sector to be able to see these projects and invest them to be able to meet their own corporate targets that they may have. And the bill also then would codify the governor's executive order around the Natural and Working Lands Climate Smart Strategy that we, of course, are collaborating on with our sister agencies and Natural and Working Lands, as well as the next update to the Climate Change Screen Plan. SB 292 by Senator Wilk. This is an industrial hemp bill on the food and ag side. So this actually conforms state law to USDA's final rule that they put out in January of this year, which feels like forever ago, but it makes updates to the reporting and testing of hemp, and it, as well as cleans up the advisory board. There were some outdated members that were specific associations that were listed in that, and then clarifies the requirements around the timing for testing of hemp. And then lastly, SB 703 by Senator Hurtado. This was another CDFA non-sponsored bill around laboratory services, and it allows CDFA to establish certification standards for laboratories analyzing livestock and poultry samples that are obtained from those species for the purposes of detecting conditions that would trigger those regulatory animal health responses that CDFA is involved in. And then it also exempts laboratories that are already complying with existing state and federal laws. The one key ag bill that I looked through all the bills that were vetoed, I would say, is AB 616, which I believe a number of folks on here will be familiar with. This is a bill by Assemblymember Stone. It would have amended the Agricultural Labor Relations Act and created a new process for agricultural employees to elect a labor representative through a ballot card election. The governor did veto this bill, stating that significant changes to California's well-defined agricultural labor laws must be carefully crafted to ensure that both agricultural workers' intent to be represented and the right to collectively bargain is protected, and that the state can faithfully enforce those fundamental rights. And he then directed his labor and workforce development agency to work with the Agricultural Labor Relations Board and all relevant stakeholders to develop policies for legislative consideration to address this issue going forward.
We have more from the meeting right after this.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Welcome back. At the board meeting, Linda Humiston with the USC Agricultural and Natural Resources spoke on climate smart agriculture and future opportunities.
It doesn't matter if we breed a better plant and the market doesn't want it, as one example. Disaster response. So we're now working more and more to find solutions that really are crossing many disciplines and involve a vast array of stakeholders around community well-being, industry recovery, market competitiveness, and really finding where all of these come together. Next slide, please. To help us get there, I'm going to posit to you that if we're going to move forward in a positive way, we have really got to find more and better collaborations of our government, our university, and our industry sectors. And you know, this slide just shows you a few examples of some of the key ones that we work with all the time. And please note, our community colleges and our CSU system are very much on there. We're doing more and more with them. Karen mentioned earlier the CSU Ag Research Institute, which I serve on the Board of Governors for. But we're also finding new government partners to work with. It's not just USDA and CDFA. We're getting a lot of funding these days from the Department of Commerce, from Department of Energy at the federal level, from Resources Agency and DWR and others at the state level. And of course, our county governments kick in a lot of funding and resources to keep the cooperative extension mission going because it was designed as a federal, state, local partnership. And then of course, private sector. And you know, the private sector is starting to get more organized around these issues, but frankly, we need all three. Next slide, please. Just one example of that alone is on technology. You know, we know we need better technology, mechanization, robots, drones, et cetera, because one of the problems California faces is a real lack of access to labor. But even if we have the best technology in the world, and this is a message I give to Silicon Valley a lot, it doesn't necessarily work well if we don't have the plants adapted to that technology and the farming systems themselves. And to get that done, it takes a lot of money. It is a big research project, which is why government is really critically important in our R&D costs. We get a lot of federal and a lot of state funding for that, and that's going to have to continue. Particularly here in California, because we don't have the kind of crops, you know, as Karen said earlier, tens of thousands, millions of acres of corn and soybeans is very attractive to a Syngenta or a John Deere to dump a whole lot of R&D money into. But when you're in a state that has over 400 specialty crops, it's not always that attractive for the private sector to really get in there and do the research on certain specialty crops and some of the challenges we face. Next slide, please. One example of that kind of partnership here in California that I think is really helping us move forward is this Consortium for Advanced Sorghum Phenomics. It's something funded out of the Department of Energy, ARPA-E, but you can see we've got both government, our research extension centers, Kearney in particular, private sector, Berkeley National Lab is on here, as well as the Pacific Northwest National Lab. This is a great example of how we've brought a lot of key partners who have very explicit skills, resources, and knowledge centers together to focus on sorghum. And sorghum is one of those crops of the future. Very drought tolerant, can grow in some really nasty soils, produces a high value, high volume, edible food source, and can be used almost around the globe. So we're really interested in something like sorghum, but we got to find ways to make that better. Next slide, please. And sorghum's just one example. We recently received this grant, which I think is another good example of putting together a whole lot of partners. In this case, ANR helped coordinate Berkeley and Davis from our UC system, along with the University of Illinois, Cornell, and our USDA Ag Research Service to create this brand new Artificial Intelligence Institute for Food Systems, where we're really looking closely at how can we harness artificial intelligence in a positive way for every aspect of the food system, from molecular breeding through processing, through the people themselves working in our food systems, and how to really enable and enhance those systems to work better. What can artificial intelligence bring to that? And by the way, what can it not bring to it too? That's an answer we also need as we look forward on these kind of questions. So that's just a couple examples that are actually evolution from previous disciplinary work, that kind of basic versus applied, which we're trying to now migrate into a mission-oriented spectrum of research. And I want to actually take it a step further. I think that's what's going to get us in the future. Next slide, please. So I'm really pushing ANR and my colleagues around the nation. I serve on several national committees for the Agricultural Experiment Station directors, as well as Cooperative Extension, to really start thinking transdisciplinary. This isn't simply a matter of getting engineers to talk to biologists, to talk to economists. It's just not that multidisciplinary focus. It's where we're really looking across sectors and regions and issues in whole new ways to find synergies and new ways to leverage those finite resources that, you know, Karen Ross was so rightfully bringing up earlier. There isn't enough money in the world to just run out and throw money at these issues. We got to be smart. So we were recently asked to put together a proposal for University of California's recommendation to the legislature on some of those big one-time monies that they might be handing out next year on climate change. And I think we actually really surprised the leadership at the UC system, because we came in and said, hey, listen, we're not talking just about Climate Smart Ag. Climate Smart Ag alone will not do it. It's got to be climate smart fire, water, and particularly we have got to weave health and equity issues into that. And when we do that, when we weave all of those into that, what we're really talking about for all of them is translating that mission-oriented research and our programs. We have a, you know, wide array of programs into policy and practice that solve community problems. We've got to get solutions to the ground, and we've got to do it through stakeholder-driven and place-based collaborations, because quite frankly, if we don't, we will not get past this unfortunate tendency we've seen in recent years for too many people on the ground and unfortunately in our rural communities to believe less and less in science and less in policy that comes from science-based data and information. So I think we've really got to start bridging these gaps and getting that spectrum to include a lot more stakeholders and how we cross all of these different issues. I'm just going to run through a couple of real key examples on that. Thank you. So for one thing, we're looking at food 3.0, you know, bringing together agriculture, food, nutrition, and health, precision nutrition. How do our supply chains work? Sustainable ag production, obviously, but things like decreasing food waste. Food waste is a huge source of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, and finding ways to connect farmers with consumers. Next, please. It's not just ag, it's our forest and our working landscapes. We have to be much more engaged in there. And these connect with agriculture much more than a lot of our farmers on the valley floor think of all too often. Because if we can really get our California forest, particularly in the Sierra and the Cascade, in a healthy state, a state that would more mimic what Mother Nature would probably have up there, we'd actually be producing 9 to 16% more water from those upper forested watersheds. And when you consider that they produce 60% of the water in the state, that is critical. Not to mention the fact that we'll have a lot less wildfire, we'll have better wildlife, outdoor recreation, and a host of multiple benefits. That's what we've really got to be looking at here when we start looking at allocating our resources for research, as well as extension and practices on the ground. Where can we get the most bang for that money, the multiple benefits? Next, one of the things we're looking at with forest, for example, is how to find high value products to get that biomass out of the forest that needs to be out of the forest. And I'm not talking cutting big trees. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking small scale biomass that has got our forest so overgrown, so unhealthy, and is a key source of our huge catastrophic wildfires. How do we get it into products that can be profitable? You know, we spent years burning it up for electricity, which is a perfectly nice use of biomass, but it doesn't pencil out, and it hasn't for a long time. You know, it costs 5 to 6 times as much to produce electricity from burning biomass as it does from wind, solar, and other sources. And we just can't keep asking the public to try to subsidize that. We need to get that biomass into profitable uses. And for me, one reason I'm excited about doing this for forest woody biomass is that if we can get that infrastructure, those supply chains, that manufacturing base here in California, it's going to be a place our farmers can take agricultural biomass to also get a new profit center that we don't currently have in many places. Next, please. Same thing with water. You know, we love to talk about solutions to water, and people are always seeking those silver bullets. It's just a human trait we all have. But I was really thrilled to work on the California Roundtable for Water and Food Supply for several years. And one of the things we put down, which is that little graphic you see in the lower left there, is a report on the need to really look differently at how water is collected, stored, and conveyed. It's not just a question of do we put a couple more big dams out there or not. There are so many solutions around enhancing groundwater recharge, off-stream storage, such as the Sites Reservoir, that frankly should have been a no-brainer many years ago, but we're still arguing over it. And not just big reservoirs like Sites. There is so much potential for small-scale temporary storage during high rainfall events that would not only help our water supply, but would better serve wildlife and ecosystems throughout the state if we would start bioengineering those kind of systems. And again, in many cases, mimicking Mother Nature herself. That's what wetlands used to be all about, and we've lost a lot of our wetlands. In many cases, having those would help us increase our water supply. And then when we look at where that uses of water go, there's a lot of ways we can find better partnerships there. The one thing missing from this slide and from our graphic I realized recently is that we're not really talking about recycled water here. And that's a huge opportunity in this state that some communities are taking advantage of, some are not. And then last but not least, I'll close out with this slide that you've seen a version of before. Well, I think when I spoke to you 3 or 4 years ago, we had this slide with about half of those icons on it, half. And what's exciting for me is as we've been reaching around the state, and in particular, I have to give kudos to my chief innovation officer, Gabe Yautze, who, if any of you've ever interacted with him, you know he's a force of nature. He created the VINE, the Verde Innovation Network for Entrepreneurship. Beautiful acronym. I wish I'd have thought of it myself. But he has reached out and now got all these different partners, community colleges, CSU campuses, private sector. We got NASA really deeply engaged with us and excited. We've got Department of Commerce. We've got so many. But up there in the upper right, tying all those together is making use of that statewide network of cooperative extension. And to Jennifer's point about getting a whole lot of landscape scale research around the state, our research and extension centers, we've got 9 of them around there, and we're doing a lot with trying to get them better able to do that kind of statewide, multi-bioregion type compare and contrast research.
You can find more from the meeting on the board website. That's our show for today. If there's something you'd like to hear more, if there's a topic you'd like to hear more about, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening. Here is part of that update.